We're here today with Dr. Robert Muga, who is the research director of the Igarapé Institute, a principal of the SACDEV group, and a professor at the Institute of International Relations at the Pontificia Universidade Católica de Rio de Janeiro. Thank you for being with us. It is well known that the post-Cold War era has been characterized by a shift from interstate confrontations to increasingly messy intrastate conflict and civil wars. Rather than stopping or reversing, this trend seems to be gaining pace, and weak states are nowadays frequently threatened by organized crime. What is your assessment of this trend, and do you agree that to understand and address organized violence today, one has to increasingly apply a micro-level perspective?
I'd agree with the general proposition that we're seeing a decline in both the intensity and the frequency of armed conflicts globally. And this is a trend that we believe we've been seeing since around the 1950s, the middle of the 20th century. But we see it speeding up, really, from the 1990s onwards. And so we've seen a decline in the overall number of conflicts from a height of in the high 30s and 40s in the middle of the 20th century down to the low 20s in contemporary period. But we're also seeing that fewer people are dying in these conflicts. So they're becoming less intense, less severe in terms of their human consequences. And along with that is, as you said, a shift from interstate to intrastate conflicts and really forcing us a rethink in the analytical categories of what is going on. What are these rolling, continuous, persistent forms of organized violence that seem to be somewhere between war and peace, for which there seems to be an inability of scholars and others to form an adequate definition? I think that this forcing of a rethinking of armed conflict is something that we as social scientists, but also as a policy community, are still struggling to engage with. And in fact, I think the question of what is an armed conflict is probably one of the perennial questions of international relations scholarship and conflict studies scholarship. We often take it for granted of what an armed conflict is, when in fact, I think we may need to rethink our mental categories. I mean, if we go back in time, the original definition of what is armed conflict or war was assembled by, for example, Clausewitz. I mean, this is the quintessential political philosopher. And he described armed conflict as really sustained fighting between two or more organized groups. And his most famous formulation is war is a continuation, as you know, of politics by other means. But I think scholars have struggled with what that actually means and putting empirical categories on it ever since. Most seek to distinguish war as the actual intentional or widespread acts of violence between political communities intended to compel an opponent to fulfill another's will. And so we've had realist theories, pacifist theories, just war theorists who've been trying to pin down its empirical contours ever since. But there is, in fact, little agreement. So just as I've described a shift in patterns of conflict, I think it's important to recall there is, in fact, relatively little agreement about what an armed conflict is, both legally, but also in a social science sense. So what do we seem to agree? We seem to agree that the extremes are clear. We know there's a distinction between what might be described as interstate and civil type warfare and interpersonal violence. But everything in between continues to be muddled and gray. We also seem to increasingly agree that different kinds of violence are overlapping. So we may see different forms of political, economic, criminal, social, cultural, ethno-political violence all overlapping and often informing one another. But I think we're still struggling to understand what that means and when that tips over into what might be described as an armed conflict. We also know there are international legal implications when violence tips into a new threshold, into something that might be described as international or non-international armed conflict. But we don't really know when that designation is made. And the dirty little secret of international humanitarian law is there is no definition of armed conflict. The laws of war actually lack a basic definition. So I think there is clearly some kind of empirical shift, but we're still struggling with really empirically measuring what that is, which takes us to the point about really trying to get at the subnational nature of the data. We need to start understanding trends at the subnational level, not just at looking at essentially macro trends in terms of whether 25 battle deaths or 1,000 battle deaths have been realized. We have to start deeping down and drilling down understanding subnational trends to really understand, I think, the nature of 21st century organized violence.
Along the line of what you are saying now, you have argued in a piece on the Global Observatory that personal security should become an essential part of the post-2015 global development agenda. And this seems quite consistent with what you just said. So what is the relation between personal security and development?
First of all, let's talk about security. And security is a loaded concept, and there's a lot of contestation within the UN and outside of the UN about what security is. And although I think there's a general consensus amongst the players who are considering the post-2015 development framework that peace and security are important, warrant more attention, when you start actually defining what security is, there seems to be a lot more division and disparity in opinion. Because we can talk about national security, we can talk about collective security, we can talk about common security, or we can talk about human security, citizen security, personal security. And each of these constructs has a particular history and baggage associated with it, which we don't have to go into for the purposes of this conversation, but I think are well known to your listeners. So one of the big challenges of defining what personal security is, and I define personal security in the context of a talk I gave at the high-level panel, as consisting of at least two dimensions, both real and perceived. On the one hand, we have security that's physically experienced, the loss of life, the kind of intensive injuries, psychological damage. But there's also a perceived component, people's own sense of fear, their threat, their inability to go out and harvest, or their inability to go to markets, or their desire to move from where they lived because of a perceived sense of insecurity. So I think it's important to reflect on those two dimensions. That's the first point in terms of trying to drill down, and that's how I've defined it in the piece for the Global Observatory. The second point to mention is that personal security, I think, is something that's universal. It's universally experienced, both personal insecurity and personal security. This isn't something that's confined only to fragile states or to a small number of conflict-affected countries, as important as personal security and personal insecurity may be in those areas. This is an issue that confronts all of us, whether you live in New York, Geneva, London, or Oslo, or whether you live in Rio, Ciudad Juarez, Port-au-Prince, or, you know, Bujumbura. It's an issue that confronts us all. And so I think there's a moral and an ethical imperative as much as there is just a, frankly, a realistic imperative to engage with the realities that confront people on a day-to-day basis. The third point to mention is that globally every year, roughly 526,000 people, we estimate through the global burden of armed violence, die as a result of violence and personal insecurity every year. What's the key point to mention is that roughly 10% of those, so 1 in 10, are effectively people who die in war zones. The rest are dying in ostensibly low and middle-income countries where there isn't ostensibly an armed conflict, keeping in mind the challenges of defining what is or is not an armed conflict. So the key point to mention here is that this is an issue that isn't confined to the preserve of a small number of countries. It's an issue that's actually widely experienced. And what we find also is there's a statistical correlation between those kinds of violent deaths and the achievement of MDGs and the achievement of a range of human development aspirations. We've done a range of statistical studies looking at the 8 MDGs that can be empirically measured, breaking down each of the indicators beneath them. And we found not all of the MDGs, but for a number of them, particularly those in relation to poverty, inequality, maternal health, access to primary education, they're strong and real associative relationships between the presence of high and acute levels of violence and lowered achievement of MDGs. This also applies in relation to employment indicators, and it also applies in relation to income indicators and also Gini inequality indicators. So we know that there are strong relationships between the two. So I think that the time has come to make a number of these issues more evident. One of the many fora in which this might be done is in the context of the high-level panel and also in relation to the larger discussions within the UN about the future of post-2015 development framework. So I think there's a strong empirical case alongside that ethical and moral case that I've just made to justify a wider treatment of the issue of personal security.
What does all this mean for international institutions and the wider donor community? How do militaries, law enforcement, and multilateral institutions such as the UN and the World Bank, as well as bilateral aid agencies, need to adapt to address the growing complexity and the trend you just described in armed violence around the world?
I think in many ways, international institutions, both multilateral and bilateral, are already adapting. And they're adapting both normatively and also practically in terms of their activities and operations on the ground. So from a normative perspective, you've seen major organizations like the World Bank and its sister banks, the IADB and the Inter-American Development Bank and the African Development Bank and the Asian Development Bank, alongside with the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the DAC in particular, as well as a number of UN agencies like UNDP and DPKO. Many of these agencies have already started to establish protocols or guidelines or standards in which they ought to engage in various ways on dealing with these new kinds of violence, that violence that seems to be below conflict threshold or slightly above it. And the vernacular they use is the language of fragility. And so you'll hear this expression perhaps less often inside the UN than outside of it, but you'll see an increasing engagement with this issue of fragility in which the social contract is not being realized, partly because of the nature of violence, which impedes an equilibrium between elites and citizens, which results in a decline of service delivery, etc. So you're seeing this kind of language emerging amongst many of these agencies. And so, for example, the OECD, and this started about 10, 15 years ago, I think you saw a creeping engagement in a way with issues of violence. And how did we see that expressed? Well, for example, in the early 2000s, the OECD launched a process around security sector reform, which led ultimately in 2007 to the production of a handbook on security sector reform, which set out 7 or 8 pillars around which donors, DAC donors, the 30-plus countries in the OECD, could legitimately invest development funding to deal with issues of insecurity in the policing, justice, penal, and intelligence, other sectors. In 2009, the OECD came up with the Armed Violence Guidelines, which also set out a set of standards and situations and conditions in which the OECD countries could invest in those kind of areas. In 2011, the World Bank comes out with, obviously, the World Development Report, which sets out the wide spectrum mandate for development agencies. And whether you like them or not, the World Bank is a norm setter in many respects. And so people often will follow what's set out in many of the prescriptions of the World Bank. The IADB has been investing in issues of citizen security in Latin America since the mid-1990s, often at the sub-state level, working with mayors. They've seen violence, in particular criminal violence, as being a major impediment to development for almost 2 decades. So it's not just those that are operating out of Paris or Washington or New York or Geneva that are becoming seized with it. It's many actors throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as in parts of Africa, that have been confronting these issues for some time. So I think that on the normative level, you're seeing it taking place. At the operational level, I think you're seeing a large number of actors, particularly actors beneath the federal level, so actors at the state or city level, especially where institutions, urban institutions are strong, becoming more and more seized with dealing with organized violence. Often you'll see cities banding together and creating PACs and a new form. It's almost a kind of a 21st century form of diplomacy, with cities becoming the primary actors, certainly across Latin America and the Caribbean, in dealing with these new forms of violence. You're seeing police becoming much more integrated in terms of their operations, both domestically but also cross-border. So you're already seeing, I think, operationally, a large number of organizations, in some cases getting grants or loans from the major development banks, to go ahead and start promoting more proactive approaches to violence prevention and violence reduction globally. There are some gaps. I think in Asia, for example, we're not seeing a lot of the development. In eastern parts of Eastern Europe, you're not seeing. Why? Because I think violence and security are still highly sensitive issues. They're issues of sovereignty. So you're still seeing some states resisting this agenda. And this speaks to a wider agenda, which I think a lot of development and humanitarian actors have raised, which is this, what they would see as a progressive and inexorable securitization of the development space. And so some of the resistance to the development of these guidelines within the OECD DAC or the World Bank from some actors, including some states, by the way, has been that this represents a growing form of interventionism, a growing engagement on some of the most sensitive organs of the state. And that this, as a side argument, might also take away funds that might ostensibly be organized towards public health or education or other primary development needs into a sector that some states and organizations feel shouldn't warrant that kind of attention. So I think that there's a good and a, let's call it a darker side of this growing engagement with security and violence, and I think one that we ought to be very attentive to.
And to continue along this line, stabilizing conflict-affected and fragile countries, above all, requires their domestic institutions to be strengthened so that, you know, eventually the international effort can be scaled back. Can you share with us some examples, some of your experience of what works, what maybe doesn't really work in building institutional capacity in fragile states?
It's a very interesting and challenging question. I think it's probably one of the defining challenges right now for many of the militaries and development agencies around the world. First of all, we should pat ourselves a little bit in the back as a development security community, in the sense that At no period in history can we say that people have lived longer and safer lives in most parts of the world. At no point in history have we seen a kind of reductions in poverty that we've seen in the last decades. Is this because of the development and security communities? Perhaps, perhaps not. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said about foreign direct investment and other forms of development that are taking place in spite, frankly, of the UN. But the reality is we're living in a safer moment than we've probably ever lived in our short moment on this planet. Now, having said that, a lot of militaries and development institutions around the world are becoming increasingly seized by the issue of fragility in fragile states, in spite of the fact that there's, I would say, a lack of definitional parameters around what is or isn't fragile. But I think there is a consensus there's between 40 and 60 fragile states at any given moment. Many of these are concentrated in low-income settings, but not exclusively. There's a recognition that fragility can also be subnational. In other words, you can have a relatively stable state, but you can have very fragile areas within those areas. I mean, the United States is a case in point where you could say parts of Detroit and Chicago are fragile in the same way that I live in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Rio de Janeiro is a very safe city with some parts of it having an HDI equivalent to Geneva, but other parts looking a little bit more like Mogadishu. So you can have fragility within states. And I think this concern is certainly being picked up within the military and development establishments globally. And so you're seeing these 40 or 60 countries becoming much more a source of consternation and anxiety in development and security circles. You're seeing a concentration of aid increasingly going to these countries. In 2008, it was about $34 billion. The last report from the OECD, I think it's gone up to $50 billion, which is a significant proportion of overall DAC assistance to many of these parts of the world. So I think you're seeing this engagement. The first point is that this has been recognized, and since 2001 with Afghanistan and 2003 in Iraq, you've seen an acceleration of engagement on issues of what they call stabilization or stability operations. And these typically follow in a way, a counterinsurgency logic with a clear shape, hold, build kind of philosophy. There is an effort to try to enable the political contracts and political settlements in communities. They tend to be short-term, just a couple of years in duration. They tend to be integrated, having a civil and military component. The most obvious example of a stabilization operation are the PRTs, the Provincial Reconstruction Teams in Afghanistan. And, you know, the stabilization as a model has got a certain appetite within the OECD. Most countries in the OECD have set up stabilization units. Most of them are seeking to enhance their civilian capacity to deploy to these areas. And most of them draw, frankly, from citizens of OECD countries who ultimately will be deployed in another foreign country for a short period of time to try to bring some degree of stability. And a set of doctrine and practice and guidance has emerged around this. Now, in the last few years, there's been a bit of a reaction, resistance to this stabilization model. There's been some sense that, in fact, maybe engineering this kind of change and rapidly governance in a box, as was once famously said, may not be as effective as we had all hoped. And there are some backlash occurring within the humanitarian community who see this as a form of co-optation. And certainly those agencies that are more dunanist in orientation, that are more conservative in orientation, like the ICRC and the MSF, I think have some legitimate and I think evidence-based claims, you know, against the stabilization agenda. However, alongside this growing engagement with investing in fragile settings and mobilizing militaries and civilian institutions to strengthen state institutions to regain territory and reconstitute the social contract has been a parallel evolution indigenously or endogenously within many fragile contexts with governments themselves starting up their own stabilization programs. The most prominent examples of these, I think, are frankly in parts of South Asia, but also in parts of Latin America, where we've seen relatively strong governments in countries like Colombia, in countries like Brazil, in parts of Central America, certainly in Jamaica, essentially beginning and launching very intensive stabilization operations, often described slightly differently. In Colombia, it's described as consolidation. In Brazil, it's described as pacification. In parts of Jamaica, it's described as crime control. But they tend to involve a combination of military actors with policing actors. They tend to involve a combination of co-opting or bringing in local leaders to try to reconstitute social contracts. They tend to have a peace-building component in terms of building up local peace processes. I think Haiti is also a very good example where there are multiple overlapping stabilization interventions being taken place, both by internationals but also by domestic authorities. They tend to involve a short, sharp element at the beginning involving a recapture of territory followed by an installation of social services, including the police. And they tend to have mixed results. Similar could be said about operations in Sri Lanka, 2009, as well as in Pakistan, and in the wake of earthquakes. And there were a number of stabilization efforts that were launched, as well as in the Philippines, and frankly, in many parts of the world. So we're seeing a growing engagement with stabilization, sort of short-term interventions, combining military and civilian components, not just being advanced by international institutions, but increasingly by local and national governments themselves might have been considered to be having fragile areas within their territory. And I think this is suggestive of a growing trend, a growing acceptance, and a growing and a progressive securitization of the space. I don't want to be completely critical because in some cases we've seen some really remarkable outcomes. In Brazil, for example, the pacification program that was set up in 2008, in a city of 6 million people in Rio de Janeiro, there are 1.5 million people, 1.2 million people living in favelas. And many of these favelas, you have homicide rates that are well above the national average. Pacification programs have involved 14,000 newly trained police who are being moved into these areas, followed ostensibly by social services to try to resurrect and reclaim territory that had never effectively been organized or managed by the state. Now, as a social scientist, I want to be skeptical. I want to challenge this. I want to find the errors in their ways. But the fact is that we're seeing remarkable gains in violence reduction. We're seeing reductions in homicide, in various forms of assault, in car robbery. We are seeing negative outcomes as well in terms of displacement of poverty, in terms of new forms of command and control that are emerging within the police force, and they're essentially supplanting the role of the Don and not always benevolently. However, we are seeing overall a dramatic reduction that's actually having an influence not just in Rio, but across the entire country. Similar in parts of Colombia with the policing program, similar also with this extraordinary intervention in El Salvador involving the troops with the various gangs. Perhaps less success in a place like Sri Lanka or Pakistan, where I think we saw extraordinary civilian casualties at the expense of stabilization, in spite of the fact that Sri Lankans want to export this model to the world. So I do think it's not a function of just simply saying these are all great, wonderful innovations. I think we have to be careful and critical and calculating in how we understand and interpret their outcomes. But they are happening. And I think they're a reality that the development and security sectors have to confront. And I think, frankly, the UN has been relatively slow to confront.
Thank you very much, Rob, for sharing your thoughts with the Global Observatory today.
My pleasure.